This July, we celebrate the birth of our nation and remember the heroes who fought for our freedoms. But did you know there are Americans today who don't have the freedom of life and liberty? Every day, unborn babies' very lives are under attack. But because of preborn, we can rescue them.
I got to hear and see my baby for the first time. Hearing the heartbeat made me cry, and it was certain that I was going to keep my baby forever.
Ultrasounds save lives. And when you save a life at a preborn network clinic, you often save a soul, as over 85,000 women have come to know Christ. To learn more about preborn's life-saving work, call #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible. Your love can save a life.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on the program on this edition of the show. Glad to be with you today on American Family Radio. Once again, the name of the show is At the Core, and I'm Walker Wildman. Rick Green and I, we host the show each week here on American Family Radio. So it's good to be with you today on this edition. Proverbs chapter 17 is where we are this week on the show. Proverbs chapter 17, looking at verse 1. Better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. Better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. Well, if you're like me, you're thinking, what is a morsel? So I did look it up because my dictionary is limited. And so to get a better understanding, you have to understand the word usage here and what these words mean. And so what this proverb is talking about, specifically verse 1, is a simple meal. A dry morsel is a piece of bread. And it's what it's saying here is that it's better to have a simple meal and have peace than to have a full feast with strife. Better to have a simple meal with quietness or with peace than to have a full feast with strife, with evil, with sin. And there's a lot of truth there. And anyone who has experienced maybe material or monetary abundance, that doesn't always equate to peace in life. Oftentimes, it actually leads to a more complicated life when you have more things to manage, more things to steward. And so there is something about simplicity in life, and that's what this proverb is talking about. And you've always heard the quote, the saying, less is more, and sometimes that's the case. Less is more peaceful, and that's what this proverb is alluding to, Proverbs 17, verse 1. Well, just to remind you of some of the events that we have coming up this year, we have some seats left available for our Williamsburg trip coming up in the fall in September. We're going to do Williamsburg, as we do each year, a couple of days before we go to Washington, D.C. So that's in September. We still have some seats, not many, but a couple seats left for our Williamsburg trip. And then if you want to join us in the spring, we're going to be going to Israel and Greece back to back. So the Israel trip is something that we've been doing as a family for 30 plus years, going back to my grandfather, leading tours to Israel. And then the trip to Greece is brand new. And my brother Wesley and I, we're going to be leading the group there to Greece. And so if you want to go on one or both of those trips, we would love to have you All the information is over at wildmangroup.com, wildmangroup.com. All right, let's jump into some of the news stories we have for this segment, and then we do have guests coming up in the second and the third. Well, the Chip and Joanna Gaines family just couldn't avoid controversy. They've gone much of their career on HGTV, and now the Magnolia Network, kind of flying under the radar. They were obviously very well known, but they weren't known for controversy. And just a little background here, the Gaines family, Chip and Joanna, are professing Christians. That's an important fact here. And their faith was clear throughout their Hallmark show, Fixer Upper. And there was even some pressure by the LGBT crowd to cater to them through their HGTV show, Fixer Upper, including fixing up houses for homosexual couples on the TV show. They never caved to that. They held firm and did the right thing by not promoting that lifestyle, that sinful lifestyle, on their Hallmark show. Well, then they stopped producing Fixer Upper. They launched their own network in conjunction with others as well, the Magnolia Network, which has been very popular. And, of course, they've got the whole Magnolia brand of businesses. Well, I don't know what happened to Chip and Joanna, but they've gone completely off the deep end here. They've gone completely off the deep end. And here's what has happened recently. Within the last week or so, HBO Max released a new series with executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. And it's an HBO Max production in conjunction with Magnolia Network. And it's called Back to the Frontier. And the essence of it is where modern people go back to the 1800s, right? They turn over all the technology and they go live as if they're in the 1800s. Pretty cool idea. It actually would be a pretty cool show if it weren't for the fact that Chip and Joanna and HBO Max and the Magnolia Network decided that they would have two homosexual dudes that are quote-unquote married with two kids that aren't theirs, that they've adopted, be displayed in one of the episodes. And if it weren't that Chip and Joanna professed the name of Christ, and these were just two unbelieving pagans, then this would make perfect sense, right? I mean, after all, this is what Hollywood has been serving up. But the fact that Chip and Joanna Gaines professed the name of Christ and signed off on this, which they're the executive producers, there are no excuses here. This is unacceptable. And it's so disappointing that believers who have very successful careers, they do so well for so long. We're talking about a couple decades of success here and reputation that they've built. And then something happened to them where they both looked at each other and said, this is a great idea. Let's have two men who base their relationship on abnormal homosexual practices, deviant practices, with two kids that are being victimized here. Let's set up an entire episode so we can flaunt and display this abomination. And there's nothing kind and loving about this, folks. This is evil. This is sin on display, and it's being promoted. It's being touted as the latest and the greatest. And now Chip Gaines has just took it among himself to go on X and start defending his own decision here, and he's trying to quote scripture and basically say that we're wrong. Christians are wrong for questioning this, for bringing this up. Let's be abundantly clear here, as if the Bible's not already clear enough on this issue. As a believer, when you platform, when you promote, when you lend credence to what the Bible teaches as sin, that's not good. This is like Sunday, like Christianity 101 type stuff. And this gets into the exact same topic of, you know, do you go to a faux wedding between two girls as a Christian? No, you don't, because that is lending credibility to, that is lending endorsement of blatantly sinful behavior. And when you're executive producing a show, you don't air and flaunt things that are an abomination. Just like, I wonder if Chip and Joanna would approve of an episode where someone commits adultery. Why not? I mean, you've got homosexuals. Why not do adultery and then do some drunkenness and maybe throw in some gambling? You see, the Christian has this issue of homosexuality, and you can lump in transgenderism and all the sexual deviancy that comes with it. This seems to be the only area in American Christianity where people act like it's overcomplicated. If we were to talk about drunkenness, if we were to talk about gambling, if we were to talk about adultery, if we were to talk about pornography, if we were to talk about pedophilia, if we were to talk about lying, cheating, I mean, the list could go on, fornication. If we were to talk about any of these other sins that are clearly sins in Scripture that God talks about, then getting consensus amongst believers on these topics is like a no-brainer, right? I mean, who wants to give a defense for adultery and call themselves a Christian, right? Nobody should. But we get into homosexuality and everybody just wigs out like it's this, like it's rocket science or something. Like it's, we're doing trig here, we're doing trigonometry, and we just got to really think through this, and we've got to, you know, double check and triple check, and we've got to nuance everything, and we got to walk on eggshells. No, it's not complicated. Believers ought not lend their name, lend their credibility to promoting or legitimizing sinful behavior. It's as simple as that. AFR shouldn't be having a show hosted by two homosexuals. Wow. Thanks for solving the rocket science problem, Walker. I know, this sounds so, like, I feel like I'm having to go back to, you know, college algebra and retake the course three times because I couldn't pass it. This is so simple. This is so simple. But it's 2025, and everybody's got to make things complicated. And everybody's got to make things confusing. And let me tell you this. I'll tell you what suffers here, if as much as it can suffer with human, you know, fallenness. The Christian witness suffers here. I was going to say the gospel. The gospel doesn't suffer because it's God doesn't suffer. So the gospel is going to flourish and advance regardless of human fallenness. But the Christian witness is hurt here. Because we have a hurting, confused, sinful, fallen, destined to hell world out here. And the Christians are sending confusing messages on what the fundamentals of sin and human fallenness are. Because you look in Genesis, and you have the fall of Adam and Eve, and you have the introduction of sin in the world, and the The core understanding of our fallenness and our sin nature is a critical component to understanding why we need Jesus and salvation. And when Christians send a signal that some sin is okay because we want to produce whole episodes on our sin, then we are undermining the core gospel and the core need for salvation in Jesus. And so this is way more than debating over, how much you should hang around the unbeliever and, topics like that. This is a core conversation about what types of behaviors are the Christian, is the Christian going to promote and lift up as model behavior. And two men engaging in homosexuality is not the thing we ought to be propping up. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of today's edition of At the Core here on American Family Radio. As a reminder, we do upload the show in the form of a podcast each and every day, so you can go to your latest podcast library and type in At the Core and click the subscribe button, and the show will be queued up in your library each and every afternoon. I do want to jump to our next guest. We have on with us State Representative Gary Click from the state of Ohio. He's representing the 88th House District, and he's on with us now to talk about some important legislation that he's brought about in Ohio. Representative Click, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. One of the topics we talk about here on the program and here at the ministry is protecting children from all kinds of things. We've worked on legislation for pornographic websites and making sure there's proper age verification in place. We've worked on all kinds of different subjects aimed at protecting young people, protecting their hearts and their minds. One thing that you've worked on in Ohio is protecting children from these quote-unquote gender-affirming procedures that aren't actually very affirming at all. They're very harmful. But tell us about your efforts on that subject.
Well, in Ohio, we were one of the first states to introduce the SAFE Act, which stands for Saving Adolescents from Experimentation. You know, Robin Lundstrom was the tip of the spear down in Arkansas. I saw her last week, actually, out at the Federal Trade Commission. And we met with some parents and some families from Ohio who've just been devastated by this. And it is a deceptive practice that they bring into the hospitals and they bring into these gender clinics to tell kids, okay, yes, you were born in the wrong body. You are two-spirited. You are trans and so forth. And really, all of these kids have multiple comorbidities. They're dealing with depression. They're dealing with eating disorders. Some of them are cutting. And the problem is they're not satisfied with who they are. And then all at once the professionals come around and give them an escape. It's like, you're not really you. You are really someone else. And you can be your authentic self through hormones and through surgeries. And we decided to put a stop to that here in Ohio with the SAFE Act.
What is the status of this legislation? Has this become law, or you guys are still working to get it through the process?
Well, it is currently in effect, but the battle is not over. So obviously we had some back and forth. It took us a little longer to get the bill across the finish line than I anticipated. We had to overcome a veto from our own governor, and we did that. And then, of course, it was immediately, sued. We were sued by the ACLU. Attorney General David Yost is doing a fantastic job defending this piece of legislation. So we've had some ups and downs. It was overturned by the 10th Court of Appeals, and they put a stay on it. Then the Supreme Court took the stay off. So now it is in effect, and we are waiting to see if the Ohio Supreme Court actually takes up the case, takes up the bill or not. But currently it's in effect. And so unless they come and decide differently, it is the law here in Ohio. Now, what's different is, of course, I know you've been paying attention to the Scrimeti case, and ours is slightly different in the fact that we were sued based on the Ohio Constitution. And we had a provision put in a few years back to battle with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And it says that you cannot restrict a person's access to their health care. And so they're saying, okay, now you're restricting our access to health care. And as you already mentioned, this is not health care. This is superstition. It's not science. And even Clarence Tappas called it a sanitized description to call it health care. So I feel confident that if the Supreme Court in Ohio takes it up, we will prevail. And while the Scarametti case may affect this and influence this, it does not settle this. And so it could have more litigation go right here in Ohio.
Let me ask you this before we move on to other questions about this. The constitutional argument, and I use that word lightly there, in Ohio, that was used, does that go back to the pro-abortion ballot initiatives where they're calling all their stuff quote-unquote health care?
No. We suspected as they were trying to put that in the Constitution that they might go that direction, but they've not. They've actually gone in the direction of our matter addressing the Affordable Care Act. So okay. They have not taken.
Okay. Yeah, I know that was a concern by conservatives is them using, you know, the quote, the quote unquote reproductive rights and all that to shoehorn the transgender issue into it, which I wouldn't put it past them in the future. I know when you're dealing with a state issue and when you're dealing with, you know, both chambers and then the governor's office, you know, I'm not trying to ask you to completely throw the governor under the bus here, but can you reason with me why he vetoed the bill, the original bill?
Well, it's getting more and more difficult to do that, and to you know justify that. You know, he is quote unquote pro family, loves kids. If I want to be the most charitable that I can be, is that he talked to some families with transgender children, which really no child is transgender; they're just gender confused.
Right.
That's a we throw around and we sanitize all of our terms to mask what's really going on. But he met with some people who said, I wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for my sex change. And that's really not true. I believe these people believe that. I don't doubt that. Sure. But the reality, they say that bills like mine, when you pass bills like mine, the suicide rate's going to go through the roof. It hasn't. It's gone down, in fact, I think. Where were all the suicides before they started doing these surgeries in 2014? The science and the statistics do not support those claims, but that is a manipulation that is used very often to convince unsuspecting parents that they need to affirm their child's delusion. And it really should be called delusion affirmation instead of gender affirmation.
Yeah.
And so the parents, like, they're asked this question, do you want a living son or a dead daughter? And these parents are like, well, they're the professionals, you know, they know what they're talking about. That happened to Chloe Cole, Precia Mosley, so many others that I talked to is that they were really manipulated into supporting something that didn't make sense to them in the beginning. And the governor bought into that myth in the best case scenario. Now, worst case scenario, the reality is he tends to listen to the bureaucrats more than the people. And the hospitals told him, oh, this isn't a problem. This isn't real. This is fake. And he listened to them instead of listening to us. And he did a 10-day tour to figure out the truth of this. The reality is I'd been speaking to him for almost 3 years about this and got no feedback. I said, you know, what is your input? Do you have suggestions? Do you have any comments? He'd indicated before that he opposed these types of things. And so I was trying to make sure that the bill was ready for him. And I got no feedback until just before the Senate voted on it to pass it. And then they wanted compromises. And the compromise they wanted was to allow these hormones for extreme cases. If it's an extreme case, give the puberty blockers and give the opposite sex hormones. And I said, well, what's an extreme case? The answer they gave me is, well, that would be determined by a multidisciplinary committee. I said, I didn't ask who. I said, how do you define it? Not who defines it.
Yeah.
And they just kept giving me the same answer. And we know every case, they consider every case an extreme case, because in every case, your child will commit suicide if you don't affirm their delusion. And so I said, no, I can't compromise on that. And I was told right there and then that he was going to veto the bill, But they did a listening tour for about 10 days or so and pretended to listen to all sides. They didn't. They talked to Chloe. They didn't talk to all of my people that I gave them, but they certainly went around and toured all the children's hospitals and talked to all the families who had gone through this process and believed in it. So it was really one-sided. His mind was already made up. He was just going out after some confirmation bias.
Yeah, this what's so bizarre is that this polls very, what you guys did in Ohio polls very strongly amongst both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, this, as far as the number of people that support mutilating kids, it's a very small fraction. And most of it's either tied up in the LGBTQ audience or in the healthcare, I put in air quotes, healthcare systems where they're making money hand over fist mutilating these kids, which there's a lot of money tied up in this industry, if you can call it an industry, only being around, you know, 10 years or so. But this is not a popular issue, meaning mutilating.
Well, it's not.
Yeah. Mutilating kids is not something that you campaign on, and it's just not.
And I watched from the time I introduced this till the time that we finished it in the legislature, at least. And the polling kept swinging in our favor, even among Democrats. And by the time when we first started doing this, even 46% of the Democrats in Ohio did not think this was legitimate health care. By the time we finished, it was 54% of Democrats that agreed with our bill. Some of the Democrats in our legislature agreed. Some of them would come to me quietly and say, "Hey, I just want you to know I agree with you on this." Mm. I said, "Oh, you're going to vote for it?" They said, "Oh, no, I'm going to vote with my caucus." I said, "Vote your conscience, not your caucus." I said, "You don't need me." And there were people individually who would tell us off the record that they support us, but they were held captive and held hostage to their caucus. Mm. But the reality is which surprises some people, surprised me, is that there are many LGBTQ people who actually agree with us.
Yeah.
You know, Karina Cohn is a person who wrote an op-ed, I think it was in the Washington Journal. Don't quote me on which one it was, but he wrote an article that said, "What I wish I knew before I had sex reassignment surgery at the age of 19. Mm. And he's living, he had everything cut off. He had everything done and was not fully informed. Testified in favor of this bill.
Yeah.
And we have Jamie Reed, the whistleblower from Missouri, a friend of mine. And Jamie is in a lesbian relationship, married to someone who was living as a trans man, has actually detransitioned since then, worked in the gender clinics. Jamie said she thought she was helping trans kids, and now she's blowing the whistle. Mm. Now she knows she was harming them. She gave great testimony. I was at the Federal Trade Commission last week, when they had a workshop on the dangers of so-called gender-affirming care. And the reality is they're coming to the conclusion, and all the evidence was presented, that this is a deceptive practice. Mm-hmm. And I think they're about to, they're poised to take some action on that on the national level to recognize that this so-called gender-affirming care is deceptive in its behavior.
Absolutely.
And that'll protect a lot kids than we can here in Ohio.
Yeah, we should sue them into oblivion. I mean, we should sue them out of business, you know, just like industries have been done in the past. I mean, this is a horrific practice that is being committed, especially on minors, which makes it doubly egregious. We've had on with us Representative Gary Click out of the state of Ohio, and he helped pass critical legislation, House Bill 68, a couple of years ago, that's been through litigation, but is now enacted and in place there in Ohio. Representative, thanks for your work, for your boldness, and we appreciate you coming on the program.
My privilege. Thank you for the opportunity. God bless you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. That's Ohio State Rep. Gary Click with us on talking about the SAFE Act, which is protecting young children and minors from these harmful procedures where they're mutilated. Their bodies are mutilated. It's a disaster. And going after, you know, these healthcare, these health systems is what they are, and these physicians that are knowingly participating in something that has harmful, devastating, irreversible, long-term effects on a minor's body and their reproductive capacity, is completely fair game. The legal strategy here on deceptive trade practices is completely fair game and should be pursued with vigor, because when you look at the victimization of minors here, it's disgusting. I mean, it's absolutely sickening. And the first segment and this segment go hand in hand. The entire, listen to me, the entire LGBTQ plus and whatever other acronyms and letters they want to add to the end of that, it's all, this entire philosophy and worldview and ideology is rooted in destruction. It is rooted in sin. And oftentimes, children are the victims here. You know, the talking point pre-Obergefell was, well, this is just something between two consenting adults, talking about same-sex quote-unquote marriage, even though it's not true marriage. And before we knew it, within 12 months, they had pivoted to transgenderism and minors. And so the victims are countless here. The victims are countless, and we've gone from, instead of just two adults engaging in sinful behavior, now we have children being victimized through these behaviors. And even using the word lifestyle is overly passive. It's overly desensitizing our populace into the dangerous effects that sexual deviancy has on people's lives. And when you look at the stats of what happens to children who are raised by people other than their biological parents, the instances of abuse, especially amongst men, double. So if you have two men raising children under the guise of this homosexual relationship, you've doubled the odds of the children being physically and sexually abused. And so the falsehood and the notion that the LGBTQ agenda has nothing to do with kids, it has nothing to do with Christianity, it has everything to do with being a libertarian, and what you do in the confines of your home shouldn't affect anybody else. All of those falsehoods got us to this point, and we have to break down the strongholds and the falsehoods.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the last segment of today's episode of At the Core here on American Family Radio. As a reminder, we've got the video up on Facebook and X and on stream.afa.net. So you can go over to Facebook, At the Core, X, go over to the AFR handle, or you can go to stream.afa.net, create a free account, and watch the program each and every day. All right, we got my colleague with us, Trey Dellinger, who is one of our senior legal counsel and policy fellows over at AFA Action, which is the government affairs affiliate of AFA. And if you heard me interview Dr. Jameson Taylor, then Trey's one of Jameson's colleagues, and they work hand in hand on a lot of these government affairs topics that we cover on the program. Hey, Trey, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you today, Walker. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Trey, this topic that you and I are going to talk about really fits in well with my interview in the last segment with the Ohio representative on the mutilating of minors and the Ohio bill, right. House Bill 68, that now prevents that's now in effect in Ohio. A similar case was out of Tennessee. A similar law was out of Tennessee and was upheld at the Supreme Court in recent weeks. That's often known as the Scrimeti case. Tell us what AFA and AFA Action did there as far as the amicus brief, and then break down the impact of that Supreme Court ruling as well.
Sure. Well, the Scrimeti case concerned a Tennessee law that prohibited children from receiving medical procedures or medications that would transition them to a different gender. And American Family Association and AFA Action filed a friend of the court brief, and what we call an amicus brief in that case, supporting the Tennessee law. Some parents who had been advised by doctors that they should transition their kids, sadly, had made that decision and had bought into that confusion. And as you might not be surprised, the Biden administration, who was in place at that time, they intervened on the side of the transgender transition-seeking parents and sued to strike down the Tennessee law, arguing that it violated equal protection. And on behalf of AFA and AFA Action and legislators from 23 states, we filed an amicus brief asking the court to uphold that Tennessee law. And praise the Lord, we were successful, and the court upheld that law.
So this, Trey, number one, this is a great ruling by the Supreme Court, and sometimes we don't get that. It seems to be hit or miss with the Supreme Court, even right, with the conservative makeup that we have today. But these cases, Trey, are becoming more and more pivotal in that if you lose them, the implications are broad-reaching. But if you win, they're broad-reaching as well. Tell us a little more about how the reasoning here, because sometimes a court gets to a conclusion and it's not really good how they got there, but the end result's good. But tell us how they broke this down and what really drove their decision making.
Sure. Well, there are really two key issues under the equal protection issue in the case. One is that the plaintiffs had argued that prohibiting this gender transition medication was sex discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause. And we know sex discrimination is not allowed under the Constitution, except in very, very limited circumstances. But we argued, and the court found, that the Tennessee law did not discriminate on the basis of sex because it banned both genders from receiving these gender transition hormones and puberty blockers. And the court said because it applied equally to both sexes, it was not sex discrimination. And the court also pointed out that this was not a case of the state of Tennessee picking on emotionally disturbed kids in an effort to harm them. When you do that, when you target a discrete minority in an effort to harm them, then the court elevates its level of review and they will typically strike those down. But in this case, the state of Tennessee was trying to protect these kids and make sure that doctors did not permanently harm them with medical procedures that they were way too young to make at that young and tender age. And then in another aspect of the court's decision, it was really important. The court said, look, we're a court. We're not a legislature. And as a court, we're limited to the confines of the Constitution and our constitutional role. That's something the court has really reemphasized in recent years. And they said, we're not going to second guess the Tennessee legislature. They're elected by the people to decide these closely contested issues. We're going to stay out of that and let their legislative determination that this was harmful to these kids stand. It was a huge win for common sense and the rule of law, even beyond the very, very important transgender issue. It was a win for the rule of law.
Yeah. When the courts default to states' rights, most of the time it works out good. I mean, there's some cases where you could have a state law out of California that is not only blatantly unconstitutional, but just terrible for the populace. You know, and I might eat my words there, you know, if that were the case. But at the end of the day, the state representatives, you know, whether it's the state house, state senate, and the governor, I mean, these are people that are most closely elected. I mean, once you get outside of municipalities and counties, these are the next level of local government. And so if people don't like what their state rep and their state senator are doing, then they can, you know, unelect them. They can vote somebody else into that position. And so I do lean towards defaulting to, you know, state control of these matters, for better or worse.
Absolutely. But the founders gave the states very great power and gave the federal government very limited powers. That was their intention.
Exactly. Trey, let's talk in the few minutes we have left. We've got about 5 to 6 minutes left. This Free Speech Coalition, which I say that say that with air quotes, because when you talk about who's behind the coalition, right, it has very little to do with free speech. But this case out of Texas, the Paxton case, that the Supreme Court ruled on, break that one down for us.
Yeah, that case was a case where we came in and filed an amicus brief representing state legislators from a number of states supporting that law. The law said that if you're going to host a pornographic website, you have to make sure that your users are actually adults to keep kids away from this horrible content. And in our brief, we had argued that from the founding of the country all the way up until the 1950s, this kind of sexually graphic content was not protected at all by the First Amendment. And even through the 1960s, as of the 1960s and continuing after that, the court found that even though adults were entitled under the First Amendment to access some of that material, certainly states could prevent kids from accessing it. So this is a very common sense decision. The court upheld that Tennessee law that required users of those websites to prove that they're adults. And they said that we make kids all the time prove that they're of age before we let them have access to alcohol, to tobacco, to gambling, and pornography is no different. There were a couple of cases 20 to 25 years ago that gave people some pause, but the court found reasons to distinguish those cases and upheld this Texas law. So that's a really, really wonderful decision for everybody that wants to protect their kids and anyone's kids from this horrible kind of content that's really, really harming them.
Yeah, exactly. The Supreme Court, man, they just dropped a lot of cases the last few weeks, and a lot of them were very good decisions. It's kind of, it's hard to get do them justice. We could almost do a whole show on these, but the litigation and the ruling on abortion provider funding or Planned Parenthood funding, most notably, this was originated out of South Carolina, but basically states were attempting to make it to where if an organization, an entity provides abortions, then they don't qualify for Medicaid funding. And this was upheld at the Supreme Court, which now has opened the door for conservative states to really tighten down the hatch on this. So tell us about that South Carolina case.
Sure. The federal Medicaid statute says that beneficiaries can get services from any qualified provider, but it doesn't define that term. And so there was a separate South Carolina state law that said abortion providers could get no Medicaid funds regardless of whether they were performing an abortion in that particular instance or not. So organizations in South Carolina that performed abortions couldn't get Medicaid funds for any purpose, any type of medical services, because they know that money is fungible and they're just going to take money from one pocket and put it into funding abortions. So the Medicaid officials in that state said that Planned Parenthood wasn't a qualified provider because of that state law. A beneficiary in Planned Parenthood sued and said that she had the right to choose them as a provider. And the court said no. The court said that the statute gave the HHS secretary sole power to enforce this provision and did not allow a private individual or a provider to bring their own suit to the courts to force that to happen. So this was a great ruling for anyone that is interested in protecting life.
Now the onus is really on states around the country to capitalize on this ruling, because correct me if I'm wrong, but now the Supreme Court has opened the door that should states decide to disqualify abortion providers from the Medicaid programs and reimbursements, that as long as they go about it the proper way in the state, then that could happen in states all around the country, correct?
That's correct. Now, there's a little bit of a loose end in that the court did leave the door open a crack to say that the HHS secretary could withhold federal funds against the state if they didn't comply with any qualified provider provision. That's obviously not going to happen in the Trump administration. It could happen in a future Democrat administration. So it's important for the states and for Congress and conservatives to stay on top of this issue and make sure that we kind of close that loophole as well.
So that's interesting, the HHS secretary provision or mention. So can a Democrat administration kind of pull this thing back, or what all would have to take place there for example, this victory at the Supreme Court to not be a victory anymore?
Yeah, what would have to happen there is an administration, presumably a Democrat president somewhere down the road, would have to have his or her HHS secretary try to withhold funds from a red state that defunded Planned Parenthood. And then it would go back to the court, and at that point, the court would decide whether the authority to define qualified provider was really with the states or whether the administration had authority to do that. But they left that issue open. You know, the Supreme Court typically, they only decide as many issues as they have to decide the case before them, and they tend to leave loose ends. And that is one loose end that we'll have to await further development.
Yeah. Yeah, it really wouldn't make sense. You know, the federal government delegates a lot of they definitely delegate the facilitation and the disbursement of Medicaid funds to the state. So to me, it wouldn't make sense for the feds, even under Democrat, to try to act like they want to get into the nuts and bolts of Medicaid operations.
Well, it's politically difficult too, because, you know, they have not only legal problems, but political problems doing that, because you know, now you've offended a state, and states typically, as you say, under Medicaid, have wide discretion on how to use their Medicaid funds. So,
yeah,
put it like this: that Planned Parenthood, their path got much, much narrower. They used their best argument, and they lost.
Yeah,
and now they're kind of dragging the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I'm talking about these abortion providers have been munching off of the taxpayer for decades. I mean, they have just been subsidized after subsidized after subsidized, and it's time for them to carry their own weight. You know, I'm just over, you know, the subsidizing of these abortion providers when, number one, their entire existence is questionable, you know, whether they should even exist or not as an entity, considering the just the wicked things that they're doing. But then, but then add insult to injury, we're paying their bills, we're paying their light bills as a taxpayer, and it's just patently absurd. Last one, Trey, we've got about a minute or two left. The nationwide injunctions have been a major problem. These lower court judges acting like they're kings. You know, they say Trump's the king. They're the ones acting like a king. The Supreme Court did weigh in on that, didn't they?
They did. They basically said that nationwide injunctions could only bind the parties that were named in the case and were before the court. So if John Smith and John Doe go and file a case in front of the Supreme Court and try to have a universal injunction that binds everybody, even people who are not before the court said, we're not going to allow that. We're only going to allow people that are actually joined in the case or people who are certified as a class action. So where that issue moves from here is we go to class actions. Class actions are much, much harder to get certified, and that's why, you know, liberal activists were abusing these and liberal judges were abusing these universal injunctions because they knew they would have difficulty getting a class action certified. So that battle is not over. But again, as with defunding Planned Parenthood, you know, the left has lost their easiest tool, their best tool. They've kind of gone now from a chainsaw to a hatchet. Class actions are much harder to certify and will be a much less powerful weapon for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Trey, thanks so much for your work. Appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely. Glad to be with you. Thanks, Walker.
All right. Trey Dellinger, senior legal fellow over at AFA Action, doing a lot of good work with our team there. And man, if you ever question the work that we're doing and the amount of work, it's a lot. I mean, amicus briefs with the Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett actually alluded to the facts in our amicus brief, meaning she read it, most likely. So a lot going on there. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.